Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, in a flurry of activity last night, the Senate debated briefly and voted on the foreign aid package sent to them by the House of Representatives, and it overwhelmingly passed, 79-18. Now the aid that's headed towards our allies that bolsters the efforts against Russia, China, Hamas, and Iran, while also providing crucial humanitarian aid to those suffering in many war zones. We want to look kind of beneath the headlines in terms of how did they get there, and then what did the president have to say today, and what does it mean moving forward? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, as we've been covering, and of course, the long drawn out process that's literally been going on for months and months now in terms of these particular aid packages to Israel, to Ukraine, to Taiwan, along with some other things in terms of some aid, some humanitarian aid to war zones, Gaza in particular. And all of those came to a head, of course, in the House of Representatives over the weekend. And then it was kicked across the compound there at the Senate, and the Senate took it up and finally got it off. They brought it to the floor yesterday morning, and that started the clock with about 30 hours potentially for debate and an amendment process. And then all of that collapsed. They yielded back time is the way they formally do that. And a lot of that is because of either the arm twisting or the horse trading that goes on behind the scenes, often back in the Senate cloakroom. And so whatever it was that got them to the end, they got to the end. And they took the vote last night. As I mentioned, it was 79-18, so bipartisan passage of that bill. And we'll break down a little bit in terms of what played out there. But I actually want to start with the president today, because the president, in signing the bill this morning, had some things to say in terms of what this means and why we should look at it moving forward as an important piece of a broader puzzle for around the world and for freedom everywhere. And I thought the president was actually very strong this morning, stronger than I've seen him in a couple of weeks now. Very focused, very clear in terms of his message. He stayed on message for the most part. A few political jabs here and there. It's an election year, so those are to be expected. But for the most part, he stayed on message. He started by emphasizing how the bill is investing in making America and the world safer and stronger.
It's going to make America safer. It's going to make the world safer. And it continues America's leadership in the world, and everyone knows it. It gives vital support to America's partners so they can defend themselves against threats to their sovereignty and to the lives and freedom of their citizens. And it's an investment in our own security, because when our allies are stronger, and I want to make this point again and again, when our allies are stronger, we are stronger.
And the president did make that point many times during his remarks this morning, that when our allies are stronger, we are stronger and safer. And so it was an interesting thing to look at how that all played out. And as you break that down just a little bit in terms of who is safer when everyone is stronger and what the role of the United States is in all of this, we'll come back to that in just a moment. One of the other things that the president hit in his comments was about the military aid going to Israel to defend itself and more than $1 billion in additional humanitarian aid for the people in Gaza. Take a listen.
My commitment to Israel, I want to make clear again, is ironclad. It will always make sure that Israel has what it needs to defend itself against Iran and terrorists it supports. But at the same time, this bill significantly increases humanitarian assistance to the innocent people of Gaza who are suffering badly. This bill includes $1 billion from additional humanitarian aid in Gaza. And Israel must make sure all this aid reaches the Palestinians in Gaza without delay.
So strong words from the president there in terms of this $1 billion that was part of this package of aid for Israel was $1 billion going to humanitarian aid. And the president said Israel must get that delivered as soon as possible. Immediately was the call from the president today. Finally, President Biden ended his message talking about the need for strong American leadership, which ultimately makes the world a better and a safer place.
At the end of the day, most of us, whether we're Democrats, Republicans, or Independents, believe that America must stand up for what is right. We don't walk away from our allies. We stand with them. We don't let tyrants win. We oppose them. We don't merely watch global events unfold. We shape them. That's what it means to be the indispensable nation. That's what it means to be the world's superpower and the world's leading democracy.
So being the world's leader in democracy, I think, is an important thing and an important message coming from the president, especially at a time when many of our allies around the world have been questioning the United States' commitment and whether the U.S. would really be there when they needed the U.S. to be there. And I think the president was trying to deter any of that kind of counter argument. Of course, this took a very long time and has had real consequences in terms of Ukraine, what's happening on the battlefront. We're actually going to stay with this conversation coming up at 1:20. Mark Toth is going to join us to look at, now that these the package particularly for Ukraine has passed, what does it actually mean on the battlefield and what is likely to happen next as a result of this aid package getting through. So that's coming up at 1:20. We're going to stay with this conversation moving along. I think it was also interesting, of course, a part of the package included the ability for everyone to seize the assets, those Russian assets, and to convert those into real cash that can be used to help defer some of the cost in terms of what's going on inside of Ukraine. And then as part of that same package, you had the TikTok parent company being noticed that they either have to sell that share so it's not governed through China specifically, or there will eventually be a block or a ban. Now, that's about 9 months to a year out, but it does start the clock ticking, I think, is the important message there. And the president reiterated that as part of this conversation this morning, that they need to either divest of that so it's not controlled by China and the Chinese Communist Party, or there will be the threat of that banishment or blocking of TikTok. So we'll continue to see how that all plays out. And now that we can look back a little bit and say, okay, what actually took place and why did it take place and how did we get here and why did it take so long to get here in the end if there was some bipartisan support there? And, of course, a lot of that is just down to the politics of it all. And then who's willing to stand up and who's willing to look at a bill in specific measures as opposed to just big thousands of page bills. And I think last night in particular, I was expecting that the Senate was going to draw this out a little bit longer, that they would use most of the 30 hours. I was anticipating that perhaps they would be voting while we're on air today. But as is often the case in Washington, D.C., when the jet fumes from Washington Reagan begin to waft across the Potomac and into the Capitol building, senators and members of Congress suddenly are persuaded to yield back time so that they can have time to catch the next flight home. And that's what happened with most of the members of Congress in the Senate. They, of course, the House is off this week, and the Senate is now adjourned, and so it is done. But the ramifications of what took place, of course, we've been talking about Speaker Johnson and his role and what that means coming up. And we'll actually have a deep dive with Eliana Plott from The Atlantic coming up at 2:05 that will give you a very interesting backstory on Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, some things that I'm sure you didn't know or hadn't thought about that may be influencing how he is governing and leading the House. So all of those things all rolled into one. That's what we should be thinking again about. And we're going to stay with this conversation. Mark Toth is going to get us to the practical, tactical ramifications of what happens next in Ukraine, coming up next on Inside Sources. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. If you're just joining us, we talked in the first segment of the program, mostly from President Biden's remarks this morning, following the passage of aid packages that will directly impact Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, and humanitarian efforts in several spots of war zones around the world. And as we look at that, now we want to unpack a little bit in terms of the Ukraine portion of the program, the most significant piece of the puzzle that was passed. And we want to look at what does it actually mean now? President Biden said that he will start within hours delivering some of the promises to Ukraine in terms of munitions and assets. And we want to dig in and look under the surface in terms of what is that actually and what's that going to mean moving forward. As always, it's a great privilege to have on the show with us Mark Toth, a journalist and opinion contributor for The Hill, writes on national security and foreign policy. And Mark, welcome back to the show.
Boyd, good to be back on. Thank you.
So as you look at what has taken place, what the president called for this morning in terms of moving swiftly, what does this particular aid package mean in the context of where we are with Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Boyd, overall, it's a good thing. In terms of the initial reporting that's coming out on the $1 billion that was announced today, that's said at some point, hopefully today, not tomorrow, to Ukraine. We're still trying to get a handle on that. It's a little underwhelming at first, but the devil may be in the details, and it's going to take a few days to sift through that. But what we mean by underwhelming is it feels more like this initial package, this $1 billion, is really to staunch the bleeding. Ukraine is in the ER room at this point. And so we're seeing this package send more munitions, more artillery rounds, et cetera. And potentially, we're trying to read between the lines here, also some HIMARS missiles. However, it's not specific. It doesn't exactly say those are ATACMs or the shorter-range ones that they've been getting. So from that standpoint, we're wanting to see a little bit more in terms of changing the dynamics going forward on the battlefield. But at least for now, it's hopefully stabilizing Ukraine, as well as giving them that morale shot in the arm.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is a morale boost as much as it is anything else. And it seems to me, obviously, this has taken months and months, way too long. And I think one of the things that has been a problem for the administration has been how slow they've been on the uptake of what's coming in and ended up in a very defensive posture and kind of a drip, drip, drip in terms of support. Is there any sign or any sense from those that you're talking to that maybe this could be a turning point and get Ukraine off of their back foot and onto a forward-leaning stance?
Right. It's a great question. It's the million-dollar question of this war. It's certainly needed. The president needs to lean into winning now. We've been in this situation where his fears of escalation have created this forever war that's just literally killing Ukrainians, civilians and troops alike. We are seeing some encouraging signs before it came on air. The New York Times has been reporting that Ukraine has deployed ATACMs that were given to them as part of that $300 million package several weeks back. And they used them to strike Berdyansk in what is occupied Ukraine. But it's that area that's kind of between the Crimea Peninsula and the Russian mainland on the Sea of Azov. They struck Russian troop formations there. As you know, my writing colleague, Colonel John Sweet, has been on your show quite a few times as well. He and I have been calling for that ability to interdict Russian forces long before they can get anywhere. And the reason that is encouraging to see that in action, is because we're picking up on that Kharkiv and Chasiv-Yar are the next areas that Putin is targeting. The foreign minister of Russia, Lavrov, is saying that's the case. The propaganda people have kicked in. Putin's Iron Doll, Olga Skupidoska, has said they basically we're going to attack Kharkiv to create yet another what they call sanitary zone. In my mind, that's just a call for genocide. So there are some encouraging signs, but we need to see more.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, that reporting from the New York Times as well as the AP talking about some of those longer range ATACMs being able to get deeper into Russia. Of course, early on in the war, the message was clearly don't do anything that's going to go deep into Russia. You've pointed out, as well as Colonel Sweet, that without the ability to go past just that front line, if you can't soften up what's behind that, then this really becomes such a slow slog that Ukraine really doesn't have the ability to win. They might be able to defend and hold a little longer, but there's really not a chance to win unless you can get some of that deeper strike capability.
Exactly, Boyd. You've grasped it in a nutshell. If you can think back to the childhood game of Risk that maybe many of your viewers, I'm sorry, listeners, have played with your own kids, it's kind of like one side gets to attack the other, but the other side doesn't. If you're holding that losing hand, you have no way to win.
Yeah.
And that's really where Ukraine has been at since the beginning of the war. Yes, there's been some wink-winking, and yes, Ukraine has been striking with drones and the like inside of Russia, but they've been denied the deep or the precision deep strike weapons, as we call them, to be able to interdict those forces. And those handcuffs have got to be taken off. There needs to be a dynamic change of thinking in the White House so that we lean into this warning strategy. And we're seeing these encouraging signs. Like I said, the ability to hit Berdyaks is a good thing. There was an airfield apparently struck by Attackums as well, the long-range version, not the short-range cluster munitions that they've had so far, was struck as well in the last several days. But they also need to be able to go after Rostov-on-Don, which is another port city that's in Russia itself, but it's a key logistics center. People may remember it from Prigozhin's uprising, because that's the city that he took hold of during that period of time. But if you're not hitting Russian forces there, that means you've got to be hitting them and their supplies and their munitions, et cetera, as they route those towards the battlefields in Ukraine, then you're going to have to do it on the front lines. And then that just becomes a war of mass. And it's just literally killing Ukrainians trying to defend that way.
Yeah.
So it's encouraging signs, but we need more of it. And the handcuffs just have to come off.
Yeah, and it's very clear that this just-in-time delivery, and I would say just a day late and a few munitions short kind of strategy, does just prolong and cost a lot of Ukrainian lives, to be sure. Give me a sense in terms of the president and the administration. It does seem like they haven't leaned into this idea of articulating a strategy as it relates to Ukraine and really what Zelensky and his generals need to do to actually win. Is that something you see on the horizon, or are we going to continue to see, can we de-escalate, or can we hope that Putin gets content with something or gets distracted by something? What's the path forward? What are you watching in the days ahead?
Right. Boyd, one, Putin is not going to give up. He's doubling down on this. He believes that he's got the U.S. coward, that our fears of escalation is going to let him eventually get what he wants in Ukraine. So in terms of what John and I are looking for is something markedly different out of the White House. Actually, a little bit of a preview of a column that we have coming out tomorrow in the Hill. We're basically saying he's got to stop, he being Biden, so predictable. They need to change it up. For instance, if Putin is indeed, and it looks like it by all the indicators on the battlefield, they're moving forces forward. You know, we can track those logistical supplies and everything else coming into it. It looks like Kharkiv is the next major target. He's been indiscriminately bombing there, killing civilians and the like, and that city's going to soon be leveled. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, Biden really needs to lean into it. He can do that by saying, hey, look, I get it. Now we realize Crimea is the decisive terrain of this war. We're going to equip Ukraine with all that it needs to be able to take Crimea. That may give Putin pause to stop in terms of what he's trying to do in Kharkiv and say, wait a minute, I can't risk that because now I'm going to have to watch my flank in Crimea.
Yeah.
So we're looking for those kind of things, and we're just looking for him to say the words wins. And as you pointed out, he has to develop a plan to win.
Yeah.
We just haven't seen it yet. Hard as we look, I don't see any sign that it's there yet or that it's even taking shape yet, unfortunately.
Yeah. Great analysis, as always, Mark Toth, journalist, opinion contributor for The Hill. He is one of our go-to voices and the one that provides great insight to us on this front. Mark, thanks for making time for us today.
My pleasure, Boyd. Thank you and to you and your listeners.
All right. That's Mark Toth again, and such great insight and perspective in terms of what comes next. And we can't just continue to be in the just enough to defend. There's got to be a space where you can actually fight to win. A lot of discussions. Will there be a strategy? That'll be the question. We'll continue to follow it. We'll step aside for bottom of the hour news. More Inside Sources coming up next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
After long economic growth, China is now facing economic distress from years of imbalanced policies that have inflated massive housing and credit bubbles. And with China as the world's largest economy, any kind of bursting of that bubble could have dire consequences on other countries, including right here in the United States of America. So we want to get into what is actually going on there. How did China get in that predicament? What's happening now and what comes next? Really pleased to have joining us on the program today, Desmond Lochman, American Enterprise Institute Senior Fellow. He was a Deputy Director of the International Monetary Fund Policy Development and Review Department and the Chief Emerging Market Economic Strategist at Solomon Smith Barney. And Dr. Lochman, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
So give us a sense for our listeners that haven't been following this as closely. There's clearly a bit of a bubble going on in China. How have we seen that develop? What are some of the telltale signs and what should we be worried about?
Well, the bubble that occurred was their response to the 2008 crisis. You know, they just flooded the market with a lot of money. And what they did was they created the mother of all housing and credit booms. So what we saw is suddenly the housing market becomes 30% of the Chinese economy, and the credit expansion is larger than that, you know, that which preceded the United States crisis in 2008. So they've increased credit by about 100% of GDP. So they've had a huge credit and housing market bubble. And that has now burst, you know, for a variety of reasons. One of them was that China followed a very poor COVID policy. They had the zero tolerance policy, which basically shut down the economy. So that was one of the factors causing it to burst. The other is that China is reversing a lot of the reforms, the economic market reforms that made China grow. You know, since 1980, China was a economic miracle. What's occurring is for political reasons, they're clamping down on the goose that's laying the golden egg. And, you know, that's another factor. So in short, China is in pretty deep trouble. You know, it looks like it's headed for a lost economic decade. You know, and you mentioned in your opening remarks that China is the second largest economy. So it's got a big impact on what occurs in the rest of the world.
Yeah. And let's unpack that just a little bit. One of the things that you have pointed out in your writing is one, this they're sort of on a trajectory that Japan went into is kind of that lost decade in Japan. And some people are saying that China is you know, about to have these problems. You've kind of hinted that maybe they're already in the middle of that. And so what happens next?
Yeah, no, they're really at the start of it. So, you know, what occurs is China, you know, just grows at a very mediocre rate for a long period of time. And that just means that what used to be the engine of world economic growth, you know, has now stalled. You know, so this means we've really got to get used to China growing a lot slower. They're demanding less of our goods. They're demanding less international commodities. And, you know, that just causes them no end of troubles, you know, going forward. And it just means that the world has to get used to a slower China. Another wrinkle is that China is really inviting a lot of trouble with the United States, you know, in terms of a trade war. You know, they start to try to export their way out of these problems, then the United States, in the middle of an election, the Biden administration's already indicated that they're wanting to take a tougher line with China. If Trump gets in, you can be sure he's going to ramp up the tariffs. So, you know, we could see a trade war with China, and that'll be, once again, very disruptive because you're talking about the world's second largest economy and a very major player in international trade.
Yeah. And so when you throw on top of that some of the other geopolitical challenges going on as it relates to Taiwan, obviously connections with Vladimir Putin and Russia, as well as Iraq and some other places that we don't talk nearly enough about in Africa, how do you see China trying to play and game this out a little bit? And what is the right response in terms of the U.S. position, recognizing that we both compete and we also cooperate on a host of things when it comes to the economy?
Yeah, you know, the United States, I think, is correct to take a tough line on China in terms of what China's trying now to do is export its overcapacity to the rest of the world. So, you know, that is no good. You know, so I think that we really do have to get China to play a fairer game. And this could push China into a better direction. But China is in a box. You know, it doesn't have much policy maneuver, and you can get all sorts of political consequences. You know, if China, the deal that China had with its people was, you know, give up your political freedoms and we'll provide a lot of economic growth. Now that is going to go out of the window, and there could be a lot of social unrest in China, you know, because of this. So this is really a big development. I'm not saying that this is going to occur in the next 6 months, the next year, but certainly a long run issue is China is moving to a very much slower growth trajectory. That's going to have consequences both for the global economy and for the China itself. You know, that there could be political issues falling out of this.
Yeah. Wow, fascinating stuff. Desmond Lachman, American Enterprise Institute Senior Fellow. He was the Deputy Director of the International Monetary Fund's Policy Development and Review Department, Chief Emerging Market Economist Strategist at Solomon Smith Barney. And Dr. Lachman, thank you so much for joining us. A fascinating insight. We look forward to continuing to see how that plays out as it relates to China. Thanks for joining us.
Good to talk to you.
All right. Again, that's Desmond Lachman joining us from AEI today. And the China dynamics are so interesting to me because they are so complex and so multi-layered. There are things that we have to go head-to-head with China on. At the same time, we have to be able to connect with China to deal with places like North Korea. And so all of those are those adversary, allies, enemies debates that go on. And then, of course, with the world's second largest economy, anything that goes south in China will have a ripple effect right here into our own backyard. And so how that plays out, what the strategy is, we talked a little bit about tariffs there. If we get into a trade war situation, that changes the dynamics. And so a lot of uncertainty in all of that. And of course, that in the backdrop of what just passed in the Senate last night and signed by the president today that included aid going directly to Taiwan to help have some stability and strength there in that part of the world. So lots to continue to watch as we move that all forward. We're going to go ahead and step aside for a quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. More Inside Sources coming up next on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. And of course, we continue to march our way through the 2024 election cycle. Big activities happening this weekend with the conventions for the going into the primaries. A lot of hotly contested seats available out there. A lot of things going on. And we're really pleased to have joining us in studio today one of those candidates, Colby Jenkins, combat veteran, Utah native from Roosevelt, West Point Military Academy graduate. And the list goes on, and is in the second congressional race. And Colby, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Boyd. Thanks for having me.
So first, I wanted to, our listeners just to get a sense of who you are. You've got an amazing backstory. I don't get to talk to Green Berets very often in this studio, so we know we're safe today anyway. But give us a little bit of that story, your backstory, and then the big question: what in the world were you thinking getting in a congressional race? Why this race? Why now?
Well, thank you, Boyd. And yeah, as you noted, I'm born and raised in Roosevelt, Utah, Utah native. And 31 years ago, next month, actually, I left to go to West Point. And that was when I first raised my hand and swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution. And so for three decades, that oath, that allegiance to the Constitution has guided my life, my career. Out of West Point, I went right into the military, and I was an infantry lieutenant first, an airborne ranger, and then as 9/11 struck, I knew there needed to be more. I knew my nation would need more of my service, so I tried out for the Special Forces and was selected to be a Green Beret. And that took me into combat, first in Afghanistan, led a Special Forces A team in Afghanistan, and then other operations around the world, notably in South America, Colombia, where we did hostage rescue missions to rescue three Americans that had been held captive. And, you know, coming out of that combat time, my command said, hey, you've had great success working with so many tribal leaders around the world. Let's send you to another battlefield. And so they sent me to Washington, D.C. And they said, now work with these tribal chiefs.
And so, way harder than the others, right?
Yeah. It's
or complicated anyway.
People have asked me, you know, what's more difficult? And I say, well, in D.C., they smile at you and shake your hand while they're sliding a knife in your back.
Yeah.
So at least in the other areas, I knew who my enemy was.
That's generally. Right. Knowing that is often the big thing. Yeah. There's so many lessons that come, I think, out of service to the country. And it's usually those we always kind of comment on the show that when the sea is calm and the breeze is light and the sun's out, every ship in the harbor has a great captain. Yeah. But when the winds are blowing and the waves are crashing in, that's when you find out if you have a captain. And you've had some of those kinds of experience in combat where things didn't go as planned, didn't go the way they were supposed to. What lessons did you learn in that process that you think you can apply in Congress?
Yeah, great, great question. And the beauty of being a Special Forces A-team leader is I'm surrounded by experts. Truly, that's what we're called, a Special Forces A-team. And one brief story to illustrate that is in Afghanistan, you know, we prosecuted Taliban targets all the time. But one particular operation, as we flew in to our Taliban target, my lead helicopter that I was in took direct enemy fire, and we lost our lift and started to go down. And to the pilot's great credit, he was able to abort abruptly and set my team, half of my team, down high on a ridgeline, completely where we were not supposed to be, while the remaining half of my team in a trail Chinook helicopter had to now flare back and go to the far side of the target. So we were literally divided with a helicopter now down that had crash landed in the valley opposite next of me. But as we maneuvered through this Taliban target, my lead Green Beret immediately had a Taliban soldier stand up, pull a pin on a grenade, and try and throw it at our direction, and he dropped that Taliban soldier and saved essentially our lives. And without that ability of being able to operate as a team when everything went south, you know, this was not how we drew that operation up when we left our fire base, but the enemy had a vote.
Yeah.
And we had to respond. And so as teammates and me as ultimately the assault force commander in that situation, I had to be able to maneuver our element through the different obstacles, through the Taliban, through the rest of that day into the night, and then ultimately to secure our downed helicopter and crew that were out in the open. And so the lessons that I learned there is that the enemy always gets a vote. You need to surround yourself with experts. Even though you're the leader, you're not the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah.
But as a leader, you're charged with making sure that mission is successful and unlocking the talents of those around you so that you can be successful.
Yeah. Wow. Well, as you look at applying that in the United States Congress, I think, you know, having that group around you, being able to collaborate and work together on issues gets so complicated. The politics of it obviously take over a lot of times. I always joke about those who have experience like you do, who have led either organizations or teams or divisions like that. And I usually refer to them as the flat forehead society. And they walk around the Capitol smacking their forehead saying, it shouldn't be this hard. It can't be this broken. How do you go about that, even in the midst of uncertainty, change, and not having complete control?
Yeah, I think, and that's ultimately where I operated as a Special Forces soldier. We're taught to be able to function in ambiguous environments where the rules are not always black and white, but your mission is true. And so what I learned in combat and how I can apply that in Congress and having worked on Capitol Hill for several years and in the Pentagon, you know, this is not my first rodeo in the swamp, if you will. But I think holding on to your mission, remembering why you are there. And in this case in Congress, remembering who it is I ultimately work for. Who has hired me to work and serve on their behalf.
Yeah.
That allows me to vote and to act not in self-preservation, but for mission success for those that I serve.
Yeah. As you've gone about the 2nd Congressional District in this whole process, which is always a learning process, What has surprised you the most that you've heard from potential voters and delegates, constituents?
Just the passion. You know, our district in particular has 13 counties, and it's very diverse from Kanab in the south all the way up to Farmington in the north. And so we've met a diverse cross section of our fellow Utahns, but the passion of the delegates has been constant, and I've been impressed with how much they pay attention to the issues, the votes of my opponent and others, and how I would vote differently. So it's been refreshing to have really fruitful conversations with people who are engaged and want America to be successful, and they've stepped up to be state delegates, to be county delegates, and so I have great respect for that. And it's humbling to stand in front of them and say, you know, this is a job interview, and I'm seeking to be employed by you.
Yeah. Final question for you. This is a question I have asked every candidate that has come into this studio, from candidates for president of the United States to local mayor, county council. And that is, as you've discovered, elections are hard, they're brutal, they're exhausting, they're exasperating sometimes. So the question is, what would make all of this worthwhile, even if in the end you come up short? What makes that worth it?
Well, to reassure you, we're doing all we can to win, for sure. So we're not planning to fail. But to the core of your question, what makes it all worth it is we've stood and we've lifted where we've stood, and at every event that we've been able to complete, we've made new friends, we've gained new knowledge, and we've helped each other lift and complete civic duties that make our country great. You know, if you didn't have candidates stepping up, if you didn't have delegates stepping up to really participate in this process, then our nation fails. And so for me, it's all worth it because we've been able to contribute positively to the progress of this whole effort.
Yeah, elevating that conversation, engaging in the process is absolutely everything. Colby Jenkins, running in the 2nd Congressional District. Colby, great to have you in studio.
Thanks,
today.
Boyd.
Good luck over the next 72 hours-ish as you roll into Saturday and the convention. Of course, KSL News Radio has you covered on all things politics, everything that's going on in the state, and things that will impact not just the state of Utah, not just the local communities, but will impact the nation as well. Those are crucial conversations, and I love what Colby said about the engagement of the voters and citizens in this state. That matters, and we all need to be that. Doesn't mean you have to do it 24/7, but we need to do our part to be up on the issues, to have conversations with candidates and potential candidates and elected officials so that they know who they work for. As Colby pointed out, I think that is job one, mission one. And again, Colby, thanks for joining us today. Well, that rounds out hour number one of Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for some top of the hour news. Don't go anywhere. We got a big hour number two coming up next on Inside Sources right here on KSL News Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, 6 months ago, Representative Mike Johnson was probably not known by most Americans, bit of a backbencher, not a lot front and center. And then, of course, everything changed, as is often the case in critical moments of politics and policy. And now, of course, he's been in the middle of some of the crucial conversations around national policy, international policy as well. And we want to go beyond the headlines of what we think we know about Speaker Mike Johnson, and whether you like his politics or dislike his politics, there's something interesting and some important lessons beyond the headlines. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, last week, of course, we saw the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, go forward very boldly, saying, "I will do what I think is right, and even if it costs me my job, so be it. The job of the Speaker is to bring it to the floor and let the will of the Congress move things along. And so as we look at the Speaker of the House, again, not widely known to most Americans until recently, and someone who's done that deep dive that gives us a different perspective, not just the headline stuff and not just what you're going to read on social media. It is a brilliant deep dive piece, one of the best pieces I've seen in The Atlantic in a very long time. Elena Plot-Calabro, staff writer there at The Atlantic, on the accidental speaker. It's a great read. You need to check it out at Politico, or excuse me, not Politico, Atlantic.com. And Elena, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So let's dig into this. You got the deepest of deep dives on the Speaker of the House. Let's just start with some of the things. What surprised you the most going into this and coming out of it in terms of what you learned about Mike Johnson?
That's such a great question. In some ways, you know, I think everything surprised me. What intrigued me about him, I mean, exactly as you were saying in your intro, was that, you know, even as somebody who covers Congress, I didn't know much about this man at all. He was in a role called vice chair of the conference, which is ostensibly a leadership position, but it doesn't really matter much. It's a messaging position. I always say he was virtually a backbencher to kind of get around that technicality.
Yes.
But I think what I quickly found to be quite interesting and in some ways surprising, though not really that surprising when you sit down and think about it, when you consider his colleagues like Steve Scalise or Tom Emmer, these were other people who ran to succeed Kevin McCarthy. Both of them have been in House leadership for quite some time. So in some ways they had an infrastructure in place should they become speaker just to hit the ground running. Mike Johnson had none of that. He only had what's called a personal office. So the staffers that, you know, if you're a constituent of his, you're dealing with day to day, if you have, you know, issues at home. So when he became speaker, I mean, it's really tough to overstate the 180 his life took. So the kinds of adjustments that he was making that maybe his more seasoned colleagues wouldn't have to deal with were really hugely monumental for him. So suddenly he has Capitol Police outside of his house at all times, you know, joining him anywhere he has to go. He's surprised to get calls from international reporters wanting to know about his family. I mean, I think it's important to emphasize how for him, this wasn't just a personal or professional transition, excuse me, but just a hugely, personal undertaking as well, and something that his family has had to deal with too.
Yeah, I thought the way you covered just that, basically having 15 minutes to put together a major staff. Most people don't recognize how small the staffs are on the House side of the building over there. The Senate staffers are a little more in numbers, but those House staffs are so small and they are so personal. It is dealing with that constituent issues for the most part. And so I do think that was an amazing pivot for him to be able to do that and put together a team and move it forward. Give us a little sense. You dug into his background as well and some of the things that have shaped and influenced the way he's addressed the job and even some of the tough decisions he's made, even in the face of opposition within his own party over the last week.
I think one of the most important things to understand about Mike Johnson is that he is a child of the 80s. He's someone who grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana. So for your listeners, that's Northwest Louisiana. This is not kind of what you think of when you think of Bourbon Street, New Orleans.
Right.
This is closer to Texas culturally, East Texas. And for him, Ronald Reagan really was an idol. And he really admired from a young age how Ronald Reagan and Democratic House Speaker Tip O'Neill seemed to have, you know, a great deal of respect for each other. They disagreed on policy and politics, but at the end of the day, kind of worked with each other with an implicit trust in the other's good faith, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And he found that hugely formative in terms of forming his own political identity. So civility, I think, you know, rather early in his political career became a bedrock of his own brand. And for him to transition to the speakership in a moment when civility, to put it lightly, is rather detached from the heart of the Republican Party and politics more broadly right now, I think this adjustment we've been talking about, because it's so ingrained in him and makes so much sense to him, what I noticed through my reporting is that, you know, there was a lot of naivete, I think, that was motivating how his approach to the job early on. I think, again, when something is so logical to you, you just sort of think, well, if I just sit down with people and explain that, you know, working with each other with a baseline of respect is a good thing, then surely they will understand. But what he discovered very quickly is that the people that he was trying to work with a trust in their good faith were not doing the same with him. So I had one member of Congress tell me that that was probably the biggest wake up call for him, that, you know, it's not just for a lot of these members. It's, you know, a very selfish enterprise about their political brand, their social media brand, not necessarily working every day with the good of the country in mind. So really adjusting to that dynamic in that sense, I think, was kind of a shell shock for him.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that led him back. Obviously, he and his wife have a partnership that's very extraordinary in terms of the way they approach things, what they're willing to sacrifice individually and together in order to take on this role and take on this particular moment. What did you learn about that? And what does that tell you in terms of what we might expect moving forward from Speaker Johnson?
Well, I would say in terms of his partnership with his wife, you know, they've been married for over two decades now. They met shortly after they, or right when he was on the cusp of graduating from law school at LSU. She was an elementary school teacher. And kind of in a continuation of what I was saying earlier, you come into a job like the speakership and you sort of realize how few people around you can actually trust to give advice with your best interests in mind. Everybody has an angle, obviously. And I think from my conversations with him, as well as his wife, she sat in on one of our interviews. What he was explaining to me is that it's so helpful to have someone with you at all times who you can go to for guidance, who you know only has your interests in mind. It's rare to have people like that around you in Washington. And so I think he really has leaned on her to an extraordinary degree, in a way that I certainly haven't encountered in the, you know, political spouses that I've covered in my career.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. And give us a sense in terms of how he is approaching some of these issues. Obviously, the way he navigated the aid packages, dividing those up into three, much smaller, much more focused, kind of giving everyone the chance to vote for the ones they wanted, not for, you know, the ones they didn't like, as opposed to a fake fight and a false choice of just either or, all or nothing kind of things. What is it that that you sense from him in terms of kind of the guiding principles of the job itself, as he's come to understand it and actually live it now for about 6 months?
That's a great question. I would say for his first 5.5 months as speaker, like I said, I think he was really trying to achieve a consensus that just didn't exist on a lot of these issues, and try to get people to yes who never wanted to get to yes to begin with, right? So people like the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the conference. And, you know, sort of encountering those growing pains that these people don't want to be part of the solution necessarily from the outset. But also, I think for him, it was, when we think about the Ukraine aid packages that passed this past weekend, I think for him, it was really important to get to a place where he wasn't just trying to protect his job security anymore. And, you know, once that, my understanding from his team is that once that consideration, he was able to put that to rest, he felt a lot freer just to do what he thought was right. Mm-hmm. And I should say, you know, it did take him quite a few months to get to that position. You know, that it was back in February that the Senate passed their own foreign aid package with aid for Ukraine, the Indo-Pacific, and Israel, and he just wouldn't bring it to the floor. That would have been an opportunity for Democrats to step in and give him the votes he needed, just as they did this past weekend. But he was unwilling to do that, like I said, because he was still sort of bent on achieving this consensus that finally he realized just didn't exist.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting thing. And I think he went in with this idea of building the relationships and getting to that consensus. And I think particularly with the former president weighing in on so many different things and it being not about relationships, but about transactions. I think that was a bit jarring for him from my observations. We had him on the show a few weeks ago with Congresswoman Malloy. And to me, it was he's figuring out those that you can have relationships with and those members on both sides of the aisle and in the White House that you're just dealing with one transaction and the next transaction will probably be totally different. Was that part of the learning curve for him? How do you see that?
I think it was absolutely part of the learning curve. I think maybe even more crucially, and, you know, to expand a bit more on his origin story, there is, in terms of ideology, this is, it doesn't get much more conservative than this man. I mean, there's a reason that when he became Speaker, Matt Gaetz immediately anointed him MAGA Mike. This is not somebody who, if you just look at his voting record, that any Freedom Caucus member could credibly call a squish or anything like that. He was never part of the Freedom Caucus, but Jim Jordan, one of the group's co-founders, was his mentor from day one when he got to the Hill. Philosophically, he's very aligned with that far right of the conference. And I think part of the adjustment for him was sort of realizing that that didn't help him at all. I think he sort of thought that, well, these people that are upset with the decisions I'm making, people like Chip Roy or Marjorie Taylor Greene, if I can just remind them that we're on the same team, we have the same policy goals, then perhaps they'll extend me some more grace. That didn't happen. And so I think part of it is, in some ways, early on was a denial for him, you know, of all the people who could have been most vocally opposed to his speakership. I don't think he ever envisioned it being, you know, people like Chip Roy, who was his own mentee in Congress, and now is, you know, the first to the microphone on the House floor to lambast whatever it is he's just done.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. This is a fantastic piece at The Atlantic. Elena Plot-Calibro, staff writer at The Atlantic. Brilliant work, fantastic writing, and great insight into the Speaker of the House. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Again, great perspective there. And again, whether you love his politics or dislike his politics, there are so many lessons in there. It's worth just sitting down and doing the deep dive read, because it's way beyond the headlines. And I promise you, you'll think again about what you think you know about the Speaker of the House. You'll learn something, and maybe even a principle or two that you might be able to apply in your own world as well. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Well, as often happens on live radio, occasionally things don't go as planned. Sometimes you have an interruption and have to cut short a crucial conversation. That happened for us yesterday as we were talking about some of the coming crises in the country, especially around Social Security, and looking for some of those voices that are thinking differently about this, or how we might look to other places than just the status quo of Washington, D.C. to solve some of the big issues of our time. And we were having a great conversation with Chris McIsaac, a fellow at the R Street Institute, where he prepares research and analysis on electoral reform and budget policy. And Chris, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being patient with it yesterday.
Of course. Yeah. Thanks for having me back on.
All right. Well, let's pick up the conversation now. Social Security reform, of course, everywhere from the president's State of the Union address to everywhere you go, it's just no longer acceptable to say that anything needs to be done about Social Security, despite the fact that everybody knows within 10 years something's going to happen with Social Security. And if we do nothing, it could be everything, especially for those who can least afford it. So give us your perspective in terms of what are we looking at, and where should we be looking for some possible solutions?
Well, that's exactly right, in terms of the trajectory of Social Security. It's fundamentally unsustainable under the current design of the program. And what that really means is just that the amount of money that's collected each year is less than the amount of money that's being paid out each year in benefits. So that's a simple concept to understand, that you can't go on like that forever. And in the case of Social Security, they will really face that reality in about 10 years when their existing surplus that they've been drawing down to backfill those shortfalls runs out. And that's when you get to that point that you mentioned of benefit cuts for retirees.
Yeah.
So, if I could just say, Congress has known this is coming, but they don't have a contemporary playbook for how to deal with it, because they've not passed a meaningful Social Security reform since 1983.
Mm. Wow. And so as you look at that, again, it's one of those that's easy to kick down the road because you're not dealing with it. And if you do say you're going to deal with it, you end up with a primary challenger within your own party, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And so it's very difficult to have the honest conversation, the real conversation. And you said that there's actually some things that we could learn from some federalism as it relates to this and some of the lessons that have taken place in those laboratories of democracy as it relates to some of the state pension reform. Describe that for us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what we've seen at the state level is that in the aftermath of the Great Recession, so during the 2007-2008 crisis, that generated a significant strain on state budgets as well as the balance sheets of their pension plans. And in response, there was a flurry of activity in the states. We saw states controlled by both Republicans, Democrats, shared power between the two parties, all stepping up and taking action to shore up the sustainability of their pension funds. And that included things like raising the amount of money that was going into the funds in the form of employee and employer contributions. It also included reductions to benefits in the form of lower COLAs and even some more comprehensive plan design changes like the ones approved in Utah to kind of move towards something more akin to a 401k style retirement plan.
Yeah, and so as you look at that playing out and as you look ahead from the national level as it relates to Social Security, is there space where Democrats and Republicans can kind of share that political risk, kind of get down to the brass tacks of how we actually need to solve this and give us a sense of what that might look like?
Yeah, I think that concept of shared risk and shared sacrifice is going to be essential to crafting a solution. And what we saw in terms of successful efforts at the state level is that the reforms commonly had those two elements. So what I mean by that is, you know, bipartisan support for legislative proposals that had impacts to both retirees, current employees, and taxpayers. So everyone was contributing to solving the problem. And I think that spirit of collaboration allowed the parties to really set aside some of the political bickering and come together to support reforms that made a positive impact on the plan finances.
Yeah. So as you look at really the daunting challenge of dealing with that sustainability, what else should Congress be taking note of, again, especially the things that have happened at the state level, that they might be able to parlay into that national conversation and some real legislation, not just the rhetoric and the bumper sticker stuff, but things that could actually help that sustainability problem for Social Security?
Well, look, I think one of the helpful things that could move things along would be to sort of think of both a long-term and a short-term solution to the problem. In the long-term, lawmakers should be thinking about moving the system towards something, you know, that is a little bit more kind of aligned with the way people's life expectancies are today, how they bounce from employer to employer, how they have access to different types of savings vehicles. I think that's the kind of aspirational version of the conversation.
Yeah.
In the near term, we need to come together and fix the solvency crisis that's just 10 years away. And that's going to require a realistic look at both increases in revenue as well as reductions in benefits. There's just no other way to make the math work.
Yeah, and the math always wins in the end. And there are the absolute predictability of consequences of not dealing with it. And so it is going to take additional revenue. It is going to take some change in terms of those benefits. Great perspective, Chris McIsaac, a fellow at the R Street Institute. And grateful to have you on the program today, Chris. And we look forward to having you back as we continue that crucial conversation around Social Security. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, again, that's Chris McIsaac from R Street. And these are things we have to get to. And neither side want to talk about it because they're afraid if they have an honest conversation, they'll end up with a primary opponent or they'll lose an election. But if we don't have people who are willing to lose an election to do the right thing for the country, not sure they're the ones we should vote for anyway. All right, we'll step aside for bottom of the hour news. More inside sources coming up next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, the nation is watching. The world is watching. And we're literally watching on our screens right now. College campuses across the country becoming the center of student protest, demonstration, disruption over the issue of Israel and the war with Hamas going on in Gaza. The movement began as an effort at Columbia University by students to demand that their school separate financially from the nation of Israel. Many are doing that right now as we speak across the country, including at Texas, at Arlington. It's really turned into something more demanding and far more disruptive than raising a voice, calling attention, looking for possibilities and paths forward. Columbia, arrests have been made, both of students and faculty, but the movement has spread to other campuses, as I mentioned, across the country. And so the thing we want to look at is, one, the right to protest things you disagree with is one of the founding principles and promises of our country. But increasingly, what we see is a need and a demand to center grievance in the middle of all of our national conversations and our politics in particular. So we want to figure out, what is the best way forward? How do we do this different? How do we raise voices of concern? How do we protest the things that we're against? And yet, how do we have a vision of what we're for and what we can actually move forward together as a country? If you missed the conversation yesterday, we were really pleased to have joining us on the program Frank Bruni from Duke University. Has a new book coming out called The Age of Grievance. And I asked Frank during our conversation why it is that grievance seems to be the center of so much of our national politics and discourse. Here's how he described it.
Part of it is America's turn toward pessimism over recent decades. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is social media and some of the kinds of conversations it encourages. A lot of it is our political leaders right now. Yeah. They're sort of modeling, you know, a pettiness and a vindictiveness that invariably trickles down to the rest of us. But when you put it all together, we're in a state of dysfunction and discord that I think is really threatening the very survival of our democracy. But I think we can do things differently. I think it's time to take a good, long, hard look at ourselves, ask if this is who we want to be, make some changes, and find a way to more productive conversations and a much kind of cooler temperature to our public discourse.
That was Frank Bruni from our conversation yesterday, talking about how so much of what is being done, particularly on college campuses and in a lot of our politics, is just grievance. It's grievance everything, that we've been wronged, we've been slighted, that the system is rigged, that the people are out to get us. All of those things have become part of this grievance. And the interesting thing to me is, you know, campus protests have been part of our nation's history all along. Right to protest, absolutely part of the deal here in the United States of America, expressing the grievance. Sadly, I think for many, has become the end rather than the beginning of a conversation. The American people are always quick to stand up and speak out. And that's a good thing. That's part of our DNA. What we're not used to is going at it with a grievance mentality and stopping there. So, yes, we yell, we can scream, we can protest, we do all of that, and then we move on. And sadly, what I think is happening is we're getting so hunkered down in just the protest part of the program that we're forgetting about the forward-moving part of the program. And if we don't get to that part, then all we have is grievance, and that never ends well in the end for anybody. For the community, for the cause, for the country, it just doesn't play well. Going back to my conversation with Frank Bruni, we talked about the possible solutions of how do we move to a better, more level-headed place in our national discourse and discussions. He said we should rediscover a little patriotism. I love the way he described this, and actually lead by example, especially for the next generation.
I think we have to rediscover a sort of reasonable patriotism. Yeah. Somewhere along the way in recent years, to call yourself a patriot, to be proud of America, to be proud to be an American, somehow that became like a sign that you were unsophisticated or that you didn't care about all the progress the country still needed to make. Now, listen, we are not we have not lived up to our ideals. And the more perfect union that we're constantly citing, we need to work harder toward that, because a lot of Americans don't have an equal chance, and we haven't been as fair-minded and as inclusive as we should be. But that doesn't change the fact that this country has done enormous good for its own citizens, for the world. And I don't think feeling bad about being American, I don't think, you know, younger people often say they think the founding fathers were a source of more evil than good. I don't think that's true to the American story. And I, most of all, I don't think it pushes us forward to a better place in the way that a kind of more clear-eyed appraisal of all the good we've done as well as the bad would lead us.
So I think the important principle in all of that from Frank Bruni is, yes, we want to have a warts and all discussion about our past, but not just warts. Are there times, even today, when we don't live up to the principles that we profess to believe? Of course. And in those moments, what do? We protest, we vote, we show up, we speak out. Those are the things that we do. But that's the key component to it. And I love that Frank pointed out that we need a little patriotism. It's not a bad word. It's not a bad thing. And this is not the beat your chest, we're number one, we're better than everyone else kind of thing. No, America has been great, not because of our geography or our natural resources or our economic might or our military power. It's because of who we are. It's what the American people do in communities and the difference they make around the world, because they can, because they're free. And so this idea of getting past the grievance and the protest, to me, is everything. Because we can have big disagreements. I think the country's always at its best when we're a nation of big ideas and roiling debate. That's a good thing. So I finally asked Frank about what is the essential principle? What's the essential principle we need to put into the mix if we're going to go from grievance to governing and defining solutions to the big problems we face in the nation?
We need to rediscover a little virtue called humility. Humility is the antidote to grievance. And what I mean by that is we all need to pause and remember that it's okay if someone disagrees with us and if we disagree with them, that there's still a productive conversation to have, because our opinion doesn't need to win the day. We don't need to be entirely right, because guess what? No one of us is entirely right. We prosper and we're most content when we value the collective good as well as our individual whims. All of those are exercises in humility. And I think if we all humble ourselves a little bit, we can advance common goals in a way that we're working against right now.
So I think that's the essence of it. Keeps coming back to this idea of humility. Humility is the essential virtue of the nation. To be able to question what you think you know, to admit that you might be wrong. I know that's a tough one for me on a lot of days, especially in personal conversations. But we have to be willing to say, hey, I might be wrong. And the person I'm disagreeing with just might be right. And they actually might have a better solution. And I should listen and be curious and ask questions. But you can't do any of that if you're functioning from a position of grievance. Because grievance is all about, hey, if you're doing well, I'm doing less well. Or we're so mired in the muck of the negativity and the contempt that comes with a grievance mindset, that then someone is not just wrong, they're wrong and evil. And then all we do is protest, and we get no progress. You've heard me talk about it before on this show, that if you go all the way back to the Boston Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party was a protest. And yes, they threw some things into the water. So it was a little bit of a violent protest, to be sure. And had we stopped there, had those early colonists stopped, what we celebrate as the Boston Tea Party wouldn't even have been a footnote in history. It just would have been one more angry protest by a big angry mob. But here's the thing. They didn't stop at grievance. They marched forward, and it took them a long time to get from Boston, where they protested against the kind of things they didn't want in a government, to get to Philadelphia in 1787 and put down in the Constitution, this is what we do want. This is what we're for. This is a solution. And so you have to go from protest to progress. You have to go from grievance to governing. But all of that requires a great deal of humility, and I don't think we're seeing that on the college campuses today. All right, we'll step aside for one last commercial break. We'll come back with some final thoughts on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues.
Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program today, of course, we've been talking about a lot of the things that are happening on college campuses, the protests, a lot of the grievance messaging going on that isn't actually creating space for a forward-moving conversation. Now, protests, we have that right. We have a long history of that in our country. And yet we also need to be able to move forward, because if all we do is stick with what we're against, there's no way to get to what you're for and where you actually want to go and what the solution might actually be. And often that takes leadership. And I've always said that the true test of leadership is not found in the quantity of the statements made in press interviews or in front of banks or television cameras, or in the magnitude of declarations from passionate speeches in front of big adoring crowds. The real test, the absolute test for any leader, is discoverable in the question the leader asks in actually pretty quiet moments, personal reflection moments. When faced with momentous decisions with sweeping consequences, the true leader, the authentic leader, asks the question, what is best for the people I lead? We have far too few of those around the world today. So setting aside the personal, getting to the greater good, I think is the essence of great leadership. Far too many leaders today are obsessed with a different question. They're asking the question, hey, what's in it for me? What's best for me? I believe transcending self-interest is simply what we should expect from leaders in business, in government, in our local communities. This should not be the exception. This should be the norm. It is the definition of leadership. About 5 years ago, I had the opportunity to sit down and have a long conversation with legendary Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, of course, of Watergate fame. And he shared with me something that just keeps coming back to me in moments like this. Bob Woodward told me that he spent years and years frustrated with the answers he would always get whenever he talked to former President Gerald Ford about the closing chapters of the Watergate scandal. And for over 25 years, Bob Woodward was convinced that the pardon that President Ford granted Richard Nixon was the final act of corruption and collusion. Yet his reporter instincts, his journalistic instincts, caused him to feel for some reason that Ford wasn't really telling the whole story. And he actually was right. And many thought that maybe it was this quid pro quo, that maybe it was the presidency for the pardon. And Woodward bought into that. He believed it for 25 years, but deep down he knew there was more to that story. And after meeting with the former President Ford regularly over a period of months, not too long before the former president passed away, Woodward asked one more time, Gerald Ford, why did you pardon Richard Nixon? And Gerald Ford responded, why do you keep asking me that? And Bob Woodward said, because I don't think you've really answered the question yet. Well, the aging Gerald Ford then laid out how he had rejected, absolutely rejected any thought of gaining the presidency in exchange for a pardon. Ford then described to Bob Woodward his internal thought process of assessing the state of the nation. And clearly, the country was exhausted, filled with distrust toward the government. That might sound familiar. Ford recognized that if Nixon were jailed and tried, it would lead to several more years of conspiracy theories, angst, anger, frustration, all of those negative base emotions that lead to grievance. He feared that the important work of the country would remain undone, and the distractions of that kind of trial would further fracture the nation. So Bob Woodward noted to me that in his view, as the way he looked at Gerald Ford flipped 180 degrees because he saw Ford's decision-making process. He saw that the pardon was not corruption, but it was actually the ultimate act of leadership, of courage, of selflessness. So Ford asked himself the right question. He didn't ask, what is best for me? Instead, he asked, what's best for the country? And I think he recognized in a very real way that the nation needed to move on. And I think it's also important to note that Ford knew, absolutely understood, that his decision would be the worst possible thing for him, for his own political power. And he was correct. It was incredibly good for the country. It was very bad for his presidency. Ford's popularity plummeted from 71% to 49% almost overnight. And of course, he ultimately lost the presidency to Jimmy Carter. But most historians, regardless of their political persuasion, agree that Gerald Ford's ending the long night of darkness for the country was the best thing for the country, even though it wasn't the best thing for Gerald Ford. And as a country, we continue to be plagued by the stories of palace intrigue and scandal and political backstabbing, power struggles. If we could just get authentic leaders who would ask, what is in the best interest of the country? What's the best interest of my constituents? If we had leaders asking those kinds of questions, we'd get better decisions. That's what leadership is about. Now, it's not just for leaders of government and prominent public figures. We all should ask those very same questions a little closer to home. What's best for the people around me? There's never been a more important time and a greater need for leadership at every level, in every place and space in this country. But it all begins with getting past the idea that only the selfish survive, and recognize when we ask the what's in the best interest of others, we get to the best solution. That wraps it up for us on Inside Sources today. As you go out into the world, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.